This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
Hello, welcome to the Fringe. Thank you all for coming. It's nice to see lots of you here. Tonight we've got John Hawkes-Reed and Stark Holborn, and she's not here yet, so this could be really interesting. Right, so this evening we have... Are you all right? Do you want to finish your dinner first, John? Are you sure? Okay, they are hefty dinners. All right, so if you could all give a nice big round of applause for John Hawkes-Reed, who is going to read us something about elephants.
Right, because we have a house full of children out front, we won't do the swearing one. It was the day the test elephant exploded. I was already hiding behind the big stable door with Hoskins when the screaming from its turbine changed from a noise I could hear to a pressure somewhere behind my eyes. I'd never heard one do that before, and I crouched low with my hands over my ears, willing someone or something to arrive and put the poor beast out of its misery. There was a dull slapping noise, and everything around me jumped, and the top half of the door bounced way down the yard, spitting big splinters as it tumbled end over end. I was enveloped in a cloud of steam and dust, and hauled a handkerchief from my sleeve for something to cough into. When I could breathe properly again, I scrubbed my eyes and discovered Hoskins looming over me and miming something. All I could hear was the final whine of the turbine, so I pointed at one ear and shrugged. He scowled and held up a finger. "Be a good girl and stay out of the way while the men deal with the dangerous thing." I scowled right back and scrambled to my feet. Hoskins had been my driver come tutor come minder for a year and a half, and should know damn fine who was going to be most use at pouring over the entrails of a detonated steam elephant. When I peered inside what had once been a stable block, I scowled again at the state of the test stand. I was going to get wrinkles, look prematurely aged, and who knew what else? At least, that's what the voice in my head was telling me. I ignored it, gathered my skirts in one hand, and began trying to work out which pile of smoking remains was exploded elephant and which was demolished test stand. From the door, the elephant looked as if it had slumped down in the far corner for 40 winks. Only closer inspection, when the dust had cleared, revealed that the dark patch on the lower flank wasn't a shadow, but a human-sized hole punched through the steel plate by most of the high-pressure turbine impellers. Judging by the white scar on the black brick floor, that was where the rapidly moving shrapnel had ricocheted away before ripping away the top half of the stable door on its journey into the next county. I edged around a pool of hydraulic fluid. I rather liked these pair of boots, and leaned over to peer up into the body cavity. Shards of turbine casing had bounced around enough to make a right mess of the inside. "Is it safe, miss?" Hoskins had clambered over some remains and was eyeing the hydraulic pool from the other side. I shrugged. "Not your fault," I reminded myself. "It wasn't screaming in pain. It was a mechanical contrivance going badly wrong, and the best thing you can do is find out why." I was terrible at taking my own advice. "Someone will have to rescue the card book from the jacquard when the casing stopped being red hot," I said. There was almost no tremble in my voice at all. Steam elephants don't explode. Or rather, the War Department had made it very clear that randomly killing the crew would be bad for morale. Thus, the steam and hydraulic systems had safety valves which were set by a man at the factory. When they went pop, as frequently happened, the crew piled out and brewed up while waiting for the engineers to arrive. Meanwhile, the jacquard wouldn't even run until the turbine was up to speed. I stopped dead in my tracks and inspected the outer edge of cardboard. All the bindings looked new, but since the thing had suffered a light steaming, it was hard to tell if anybody had tampered with the code by pasting in a duff card. I stared up at the back of the Theosophical Society building, wondering how to explain my suspicions to the Colonel. There was going to be a board of inquiry, and the most likely explanation was going to be some unforeseen mechanical failure because of substandard castings or mice in the grunge wheels. And that was the most likely explanation. The Colonel and Zoe and Hoskins were going to shake their heads patiently and call me a silly girl for even suggesting someone would be able to make an elephant explode. And even more preposterous was the notion that they should be able to do it by sneaking something into the jacquard commands. I turned the card book over in my hands. I knew what the original code should look like because I'd written most of it myself. However, this was a newer book, and because the Colonel had been keeping me busy, I would have to go and ask someone what some of the parts did. That would be frustrating and embarrassing and lead to the sort of questions to which I only had angry answers. No, I was going to work this one out for myself, no matter how long it took. I was on my third circuit of the Grand Central Staircase when I had one of my better ideas. The late afternoon sun was streaming through the big rose window, lighting up the greater part of three stories of stairwell. I scampered up the last two flights and looked about me. Ha! There it was. A brass shell casing that served as an ashtray for people who liked to lean on the banister and stare out at the gardens behind the Theosophical Society. I opened the card book and tipped the end out into space, hoping that it didn't rip itself to pieces as it cascaded open. I weighed the cover of the book down with the shell casing and beetled back down to the floor below to survey what I had wrought. The entire elephant program hung down over 2.5 stories. I sat on the landing carpet, leant my head on the stair rods, and tried not to concentrate on any particular part of the book at once. Code has patterns if you look at it the right way. In the same way that the sound of a train journey are a set of repeating patterns, or the noise made by a properly running elephant are more pleasant than the one that's been maintained by someone with no manual and a big hammer, so the code that controls the running has patterns of its own that can look right or wrong. I didn't spot it straight away. I could see the original walking code, and my patches that allowed the elephant to run without destroying the knee clutches. It wasn't until the sun reappeared from behind a cloud that two extra runs of holes revealed themselves on the far left-hand edge of a handful of cars, more or less level with Colonel Elliot's face. He had braced his hands against the fourth-floor banister and was peering out into the stairwell to see the bottom end of the code book. He looked back up and raised his eyebrows when he saw me watching him. "Miss Butler," he said, "I'm sure you have a most entertaining explanation for this." He gestured at a gently rippling column of cars. "I do. Sabotage. 18 months ago, I was a mostly useless younger daughter. Then I proved I was a better jacquard hacker than, everyone at my father's factory, which led to something of an adventure with dock cranes animated by the captured spirit of the recently dead. This meant that I was a sad disappointment as a youngest daughter, but the colonel and his group of jacquardists, ex-soldiers, and otherwise adventuresome types fell upon me like the returning prodigal. Or maybe I was the fatted calf. Some days it was hard to tell. Thus, I spent several months under the tutelage of Miss Zoe Harker, in which we discovered how little we knew about each other's fields, and what felt like far too long with Sergeant James Hoskins, in which we discovered that I could probably hit a barn with a 20-bore shotgun, assuming I was inside with the doors closed. "Now then," said the Colonel, "sabotage? How? And why?" I sat back in the chair nearest the window and rifled through the code book until I had found the unidentified slots. "This is probably the how," I said, brandishing the book at the colonel. He peered at it over his half-moon spectacles. "I think we'd better send for Miss Harker, don't you?" He scribbled a note, folded it into one of the several small cylinders scattered on his desk, and stuffed the message capsule into the Lamson tube bolted to the side of the fireplace. There was a muffled thump as the vacuum dragged the capsule towards Zoe's office, which was next to the big jacquard in the basement. There was another thump, followed by a chime as a new capsule bounced off the "You have a new message" bell. The colonel inspected the contents and peered over his spectacles again. "Miss Harker commands me to tell you, and I quote, do try to keep the silly girl from killing herself until I can arrange for tea and cake. So." I started to protest, but the colonel held up a finger like a cricket umpire giving out. "I have already sent Hoskins off to the bosom of his family so he can recover. I'm sure you'd prefer I didn't afford you the same opportunity. So, again, tell me about your trip to Malvern." I pitched up at the Royal Steam Research Establishment as instructed, and spent the morning being wheeled about the boring bits by some old sweat who ran on pink gin. When he nodded off after his second lunchtime brandy, I toddled off back to the works under Malvern Wells that he'd carefully avoided. The colonel was nodding and scratching notes. I carried on. There was a huge square and compass above the entrance to the tunnels, which rather gave the game away, but there was something terribly odd about the square. My eyes seemed to slide off it, and if I tried to concentrate on the thing, I started to see a kaleidoscope, and the left hand of my head began to ache. It was a lot like the square wasn't actually square at all. I pressed on into the main hall, where there was a dozen huge steam locomotives in various states of repair, attended by chaps dressed in heavy smocks and goggled helmets. It reminded me of Piranesi and Bruegel all at once. "Did you find it?" said the colonel. "I did. Whatever they're using for fuel in those engines, it's not coal. Coal does not go blue. I scooped a trowelful into that blasted lead-lined handbag you had me cart around like it weighed nothing, and scarpered in the general direction of Malvern Station and point southwest." I paused. "Do you know what it is yet?" The colonel wiggled a folder from under several message canisters and tapped it. "Not really. Rutherford's being a donkey about it and insists the stuff comes from West Africa. I think you're onto something with the Masons, but I don't think the ritual they follow is one that would be familiar to anybody on this earth. I folded my arms. Martians? Spirits? I know we're in Madame Blavatsky's back bedroom, but really? The Colonel sighed. You should keep an open mind, Miss Butler, especially given the circumstances of our first meeting. No, not spirits nor Martians. I think that mineral comes from a place where the geometry doesn't work and our laws of nature don't apply. I think you're going to have to explain that, I said. You're familiar with the Hollow Earth theory? I considered rolling my eyes at this point, but as the Colonel pointed out, I had shot a distress rocket into the control cabin of a marauding dock crane from a howdah atop a steam elephant. Holes in the poles, I said. Yes, Charles Fort is quite illuminating on the subject. Between Jacquard hacking and failing to shoot anything, I had been able to lose myself in the library for days at a time. Getting to the section marked Esoterica had involved scaling particle theosophy and an interesting traverse through computational philosophy. Very good. There are many stories of entrances to inner Earth being scattered across the surface of the globe, one of which apparently was discovered by a Staffordshire ploughman in the 18th century. It would not surprise me to learn that these locomotive-filled tunnels under the Malverns go somewhere very strange indeed. And this entrance is guarded by something that looks like a Masonic lodge, but is in fact something else? Oh, I think they think it's all normal enough, but their particular great architect is far stranger than they realise. Most people wouldn't have paid proper attention to the square that isn't square. There was a cough and a rattle of saucers from behind me. Debrief complete, said Zoe, from the far side of a tray of tea and cake. I think so, said the Colonel. That is, unless Miss Butler had anything to add. I held up a finger. Debrief? Zoe handed me what looked like a tureen of tea and a quarter of a fruitcake. You've heard of a briefing, yes? I nodded and wondered where to put my prizes. There was a clatter as the Colonel swept some more message canisters into a wicker bin. I leaned forward to perch both cake and tureen on the edge of the desk. Well then, briefing and debriefing. We've sucked your brain clear of all the terrible things. I raised an eyebrow. I very firmly doubted that statement. And now we can talk about something else, said Zoe, settling in a wingback chair opposite mine. I paused to gulp tea. I seemed to be doing rather a lot more talking than I expected. That was odd. Such as, I said. Zoe grinned. Such as those extra slots you found in the Elephant Code Book. We have three mysteries, I believe, said the Colonel. First, what are those extra slots? Second, who put them there? And third, why? Four mysteries. How did someone get that code book into the test elephant, I said. The day after, I was careful to wear the boots and the day dress I had found most suitable for scaling library shelves. The sensible thing would have been to go and inspect a Jacquard 7, but since the only one close at hand was now scrap, since it had taken a direct hit from a flying turbine blade. Father would have had one or two in a half-completed elephant, but there had been an incident at the works, and there would be no more Jacquard 7s for the foreseeable future. The smaller Jacquards had been built originally by the crypto masons at the RSRE, so if you wanted to know anything about the internals, you had to go and petition the War Department, who would then huff on about national security and tell you nothing. That was the official version, anyway. The sort of people who seem best suited to hacking away on Jacquards were also the sort of people who generally have alarm clocks or frogs to pieces as children to see how they worked. Tip-top Jacquard hackers were generally the ones who'd been able to put the things they disassembled back together without any parts left over and without leaving a trail of clockwork frogs or leaping clocks. They also liked to share their discoveries with like-minded souls, which is why I was descending with a box file containing the complete run of 2 and 6, the Jacquard Hacker Quarterly, clutched one-handed to my bosom. Next time I'd borrow a newsboy's bag and leave both hands free for not falling to my doom, or at least the risk of a turned ankle on a lecture about proper decorum in the library. Honestly, if they're going to fill a room with full-height shelves and hide all the interesting books in the top two rows, what on earth do they expect to happen? Half an hour later, I skidded to a halt in Zoe's office, waving a copy of 2 and 6 at her. Found it! I squeaked. She held up her hand and continued methodically stabbing holes into a card book. I knew that state, so I stood there and tried not to bounce up and down. I could interrupt her, but then she'd lose the logic sequence in her head, and while she'd be gracious about it, it would take her another 20 minutes to get back to where she'd been, and when I've been in the same position, I've chiefly contemplated bloody murder of the interrupter. What have you found? She said, after a while. I brandished the magazine. This! Zoe sat back and scanned the article. About halfway through, she began nodding, and then looked up and grinned at me. By Jove, I think you've got it. We should report this upstairs. A steam organ, said the Colonel. Yes. I was pacing between the book stacks while Zoe egged me on from the sidelines. Some careless sort drove a showman's wagon into a steam elephant outside Tenbury Wells, and in the confusion before a policeman arrived, a couple of enterprising fellows had a good look at both the jacquard in the elephant and the remains of the wagon, which had been a Wurlitzer 164 dance organ. The card-reading mechanisms were startlingly similar, according to reports. Which is all very well, but as the saying goes, code book or it didn't happen. So I took the opportunity to beetle down to the music shop at the top of Christmas Steps and discovered this. I hauled an organ book out of its brown paper bag and dropped it on the colonel's desk. He peered at it, and then turned to dig the suspect elephant code book from wherever he'd hidden it. He laid the book side by side and flipped through the cards. The programming was obviously different, but the layout of the cards was distressingly similar. He stopped flipping the code book when he came to the section with the mystery slots, but continued working through the organ book until he'd found the same format slots. "Excellent work, Miss Butler," he said. "What do you suggest as a next move?" I looked at Zoe for moral support. She made a shooing motion. I guess that meant she was happy for me to take charge. "I think I would like to find out what IAG Oxford might be, because that's where the original report came from." The Colonel nodded. "Very well. That seems like as good a lead as any, Miss. Miss Harker, could you warm up your jacquard and see what intelligence we may already have? It might be best to keep that job under your hat and run it overnight." Zoe stood. "As you wish." She turned to me. "Olivia, could you go back to the music shop and inquire about those slots in the cards?" "I could. But do you think it might be a bit obvious going to the nearest shop to the Theosophical Society and starting to ask about the inner workings of steam organs?" "Good point. Do we know if there's an organ works in the area?" "Tewkesbury." I said it without thinking. Zoe and the Colonel goggled at me. I felt myself blushing the same way I did when I'd called one or another an idiot over Christmas. I had to change trains in Worcester last month. There was an advertising hoarding. It had a surplus apostrophe, and that stuck in my head because I wanted to find a brush and paint it out. If I'd been a phonograph, my voice would have deepened as I ground to a halt. Thank you. It goes on some.
Thank you, John. That was awesome. If you want to know the end of that story, it will be in North by Southwest, which is out somewhere soon in the future. Okay, take a break, have a wee, grab a drink, grab some food. We'll be back in 10 minutes with Stark.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.